You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Go Dig a Hole. This is your host, Christopher Sims. This show is your archaeology toolkit, where I'll bring you resources to kickstart your career in archaeology. If you're still in school, thinking about going back, just getting started, or want to take the next step, Go Dig a Hole has you covered. All right, now let's get on with the show.
Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com.
Hello and welcome to the 16th episode of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. Today we're going to talk about queer archaeology, queer theory, and why it's important. Today I've got two special guests on the line. I've got Chelsea Blackmore. Chelsea, how's it going?
It's going well, thanks.
And I've also got Megan Springate. Megan, how's it going today?
Good, Chris. Thanks.
Nice. So, Chelsea, could you give us a brief background on where you're at and what you're working on?
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and I'm currently working on a couple different projects. One is a book project on prehistoric states and queer theory and feminism, and my actual new archaeological project that I'm starting is in southern Belize. It's a excavation and survey of historical sites in southern Belize.
Awesome. And Chelsea, I met you at the last Maya at the Lago conference, which is
correct
in North Carolina every year. And
right.
So it was a pleasure to meet you, and it was great to learn about your work there. And I was really impressed with how much queer theory played a role, like such an important role in work on the Maya, but also the work of all of the colleagues presenting there and everybody in attendance there. So that was kind of my introduction to queer theory's role in studying the Maya. So that was really neat, and we can talk more about that further on in the podcast here.
Sure.
And Megan, how about you? Let's hear what you're up to and what your background is.
Sure. So I'm wearing a couple of hats right now. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Maryland in the anthropology department. And so I'm working on finishing up my dissertation. And I also work for the National Park Service as interpretation coordinator for the Cultural Resources Office of Interpretation and Education. So although I work for the Park Service, not speaking as a Park Service person in this interview, and so the views and opinions that I have are not necessarily those of the National Park Service.
Very cool. And so to start off, before we really jump into what queer archaeology is, I've got a few quotes from one of Chelsea's papers, and this paper I found on academia.edu. I'll link it in the show notes on archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/go-dig-a-hole. And if you happen to find the podcast on social media, it'll have the links for all that there. But the paper is called How to Queer the Past Without Sex: Queer Theory, Feminisms, and the Archaeology of Identity. And the first quote that is a good introduction and starting point to anybody not familiar with this is right there in the abstract, and it explains roughly queer archaeology in a nutshell. And so, Chelsea, you said, "A queer archaeology is often equated to looking for ancient homosexuality. As a challenge to heteronormative practice, queer theory instead provides a framework for engaging with all aspects of identity formation and the processes and behaviors that mediate it." And then you go on to say that, one, queer theory's relationship to feminist practice and archaeology, and two, its application to the construction and production of difference among ancient Maya commoners. Those are the two primary points that you cover in this paper. Mm-hmm. Would you say that that's broadly applicable to other applications of queer theory in archaeology?
Well, it began, I mean, really the kind of concept of queer theory obviously came from outside of archaeology, as a lot of our kind of theoretical points of view do. The idea of using queer theory or thinking about things like gender, sex, and sexuality in terms of archaeology really began kind of in and around with the advent of the feminist archaeology. You know, Meg Conkey, Joan Jarrow, and others, you know, Rosemary Joyce. And then the queer part of the equation kind of came in with archaeologists like Barb Voss, Eleanor Casella, Mary Weissmantel, and others who were kind of looking at these discussions around gender and sex, much like it was done in other disciplines, and questioning whether or not we really understood sex and sexual relationships. And so it really began as kind of an archaeologies of sex and sexuality. And then queer theory kind of became a way to consider all of that, but also just to consider what isn't normative, what to focus on those things that societies consider dangerous or immoral, and kind of question the contexts of those situations.
That's great. And you also have a comment here in the introductory part of the paper that earlier, quote unquote, add women and stir models have given way to research agendas that recognize multivocality of gendered identities. And I really love the add women and stir phrase to refer to that, because this isn't a criticism of early feminist theory, but so much as a criticism of, I think, archaeological theory as a whole that was happening, I don't know, in like the 60s and 70s, that we're still quite binary and we're still having a hard time accepting multivocality, as you say. And so they're not very nuanced. And so I think if I'm getting this right, queer theory as it stands now is really helping to bring more complexity and nuance and more of the human variable into studying, you know, human behavior, even beyond like sex and sexuality.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of different things have. I mean, like any theoretical perspective, we have to realize that it has a history and an interrelationship with all different kinds of strands of theory, and owes a thanks to everything from, you know, Marxism to feminism to post-processualism to processualism, right? Without those things, we wouldn't be able to, you know, kind of have these heady discussions around complexity in the same way. I think the point of queer theory is that all the things are tied into ways that people, you know, that gender, sex, and sexuality are tied into all facets. So they're tied into the ways in which people politically organize, you know, their world, their families, how people interact with one another. They're interrelated to class relationships. So I think that's the point, is that, you know, queer theory comes out of this perspective of questioning kind of a heteronormative, straight, white perspective of the past, and says, well, that's not the only one, if that in and of itself was actually a real set of categories.
Yeah. It I think in a way it goes a long way to decolonizing, I guess if you could call it, like decolonizing archaeological theory and kind of breaking apart the, you know, heteronormative, binary, and even like, as you had said, a reference to Marxism, kind of breaking apart these kind of capitalist binaries that we're sloppily applying in the past to past cultures. And so, you know, like we had said, we're moving into more and more complex human behavior and interaction here. And for anybody who's just starting off in archaeology, I think that queer theory is an important starting point, because it's going to skip a lot of the growing pains of archaeological theory and start to work through that. But also, it'll give a better and richer understanding of past cultures in ways that you know, are often difficult. Like you can't apply, you know, cultural values and economic and political systems from 2017 to, you know, the ancient Maya or any other culture for that matter.
Yeah, and some people would argue then how can queer theory be applicable? But that's the very point of for me at least, you know, when you queer something, you try to figure out what the context is.
And you try to invert it on its head. So we can't look for ancient homosexuality because that category, you know, wasn't around until the last few centuries, you know, so we have to put it within the possible context, you know, of the society. And that gets harder because, you know, these kinds of things don't clearly, you know, they don't just magically show up in the archaeological record clear and concise, you know.
Yeah. Let's see, we've still got about 5 minutes before I'm going to pause for a commercial break. So, Chelsea, I think it's interesting to use queering as a verb. Could you explain kind of using it as a verb?
Yeah, sure. To queer something is to denaturalize it, to deconstruct it. I really think of it as terms of deconstruction, really, of pulling it apart and questioning and placing the what's considered the not normal, the other categories in a position of privilege, and just kind of upending things. So to queer something is to basically screw around with it in not so subtle terms, which I think, you know, as academics in the way we think about things, you know, why shouldn't we, you know, mess around with ideas and concepts, you know, obviously within certain contexts, but, you know, why shouldn't we think creatively and think about the different ways in which societies could have lived?
Yeah,
I think this is Megan. So to me, I think queering is a
challenge as well. It's a challenge to how you think the world works, right? So to me, queer archaeology also includes things like challenging the ideas of past and present and challenging the assumption that, you know, all cultures view time in a linear fashion the same way we do, or that there's some sort of real break between what is past and what is present, what is prehistoric, you know, what is prehistoric, what is historic. And you know, maybe those things do hold, but to queer it is a challenge and says, you know, prove it.
You know, right. Look at your data and tell me why you think it is the way that you think it is. And opens up the possibility for, you know, all of these other ways
all of these other understandings of the way that the world can work. Yeah, I would even connect it to this is Chelsea, to go off Megan's point, is that it's also a political challenge. It's a challenge. It's
you know, what we're doing isn't necessarily that different in many respects from other critiques and criticisms, but to queer something for me is also a political challenge of making archaeology
as relevant and as inclusive as we can.
I think those are great points. And one of the recurring themes that I try to work with on the Go Dig a Hole podcast and with my blog is doing work to build a more inclusive archaeology. And so the starting point for us on this podcast is for, you know, early career archaeologists and for undergrads, but also as a whole, I think that the field needs to have that as even a stated mission statement. You know, just that needs to be part of the operating procedure is, you know, mostly to adopt queer theory in many ways.
I think what we do is inherently political, even if it's quote unquote just, to help somebody through the permitting process. If you're doing cultural resource management, that's still,
you know, behind that process is decades of, you know, political maneuvering and mm-hmm. and writing of laws and deciding, you know, what requires permits
that require archaeology and what doesn't. So I think even outside of sort of the academic approaches to archaeology, I think it's still what we do is political and affects our understanding of ourselves and the past.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say that the inclusivity thing is important, and I think most archaeologists speak to it, but
we need to be much more cognizant and realistic of the ways that we actually include people. And that requires a lot of us to think very deeply and, you know,
identify our own privileges and ways in which we benefit from things like white supremacy and heteronormativity, and how those keep certain groups of people in power, both, you know, within our world, within
our discipline, you know, how it gives some people advantages and takes away. So it's also a matter of creating an inclusive archaeology that, you know, and it makes for a better discipline, and I think
for a better science, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think that's a good spot to take our first quick commercial break, and we'll be right back to talk about how to build a more inclusive archaeology.
I'm here with Michael Ashley from Codify.com, and we're going to talk about the new photo boards that they're developing and why we need them. Michael, what's important about a photo board, and why does someone have to really think about what they use in the field or in the lab?
You know, Chris, it's interesting when we look at field photos, the way we've been taking them hasn't changed much in the past 100 years. Some people may use the back of a clipboard or paper sheet to provide a clean background, or go to the trouble of using those photo boards with all the letters, but we really need our photos to do a lot. We need a new kind of photo board that can help us achieve consistent color, provide scale, and help us measure things, especially if we're not collecting artifacts and we have just one chance to get it right. Developing a photo board that can do all these things, especially designed for digital photography, well, this is a challenge. It needs to be indestructible, weatherproof, fadeproof, lightweight, portable, and affordable.
So what is Codify developing, and as it says on the website, what makes it magic?
All right, in our lab and field testing, we started with a 10 by 12 inch board, big enough for most artifacts we encounter in the field, but not so big it would be a pain to carry. The board is magic because it has special markers on it that will produce a measurable model in 3D just from taking a few photos, and the object will be magically color balanced by using the board as a background. There's space on the bottom so we can superimpose a digital caption and company logo, plus a space for either physical barcodes or virtual ones to dramatically improve field and lab accessioning of artifacts and samples. So we've already received a lot of suggestions for other boards, so we're releasing a 4x6-inch pocket board in both Imperial and Metric. And we're psyched about our directional arrow, which has both metric and standard scales on it, and will white balance your photos. It's really cool.
So when can people expect to get one of these photo boards, and where can they get them?
All right, well, we're excited to say that we have a limited run in production right now, shipping just in time for holiday gifts. We want to get these in your hands and look forward to your feedback. Chris, what kind of deal can APN listeners get?
All right, well, just head over to www.codify.com/APN for a discount code that's valid only on that day and for other ongoing discount codes just for you. That's codify.com/APN. Thanks for listening, and now back to the show.
All right, and we're back. And so, Megan, where would you see a good starting point for undergrads or early career archaeologists to go to in terms of equipping themselves with the skills to work with queer theory in archaeology?
I think there's some good
introductory stuff. There was a bunch of stuff done in queer theory in archaeology in the early 1990s, and then it sort of laid low for a while and is really sort of starting to come back in a much
more broader sense. So in this more broader definition of queer archaeology than just the archaeology of homosexuality.
So
Chelsea and Don Rutecki this past January, issue of the Society for American
concise introduction to both
doing queer archaeology and what it is and how you can use it, but also what it means to be queer as an archaeologist.
Because, you know, there's certainly issues in being queer in the field. And those issues are both
positive and negative.
Yeah, that goes back to your point that you had made earlier about how our work as archaeologists is inherently political. And so it's not just the work we're doing, but it's the people doing the work.
Absolutely.
Nice. Well, so what would be a starting point then for the discipline as a whole to be more inclusive to queer archaeology?
I think when somebody's,
you know, doing their analysis or they're writing up their interpretation and they just very easily make a correlation between,
you know, some evidence and an interpretation that just seems like it's obvious, that we really sort of stop and say, wait, what makes this an obvious
connection, and think really carefully about, are there other ways that we could interpret this? Where am I getting this idea that this is an obvious connection?
Yeah.
I mean, we still see,
you know, for those archaeologists who are in undergrad or who have taught undergrad, you know, we show these films about early hominid evolution and we see
family units of a male and a female and you know, 2.4 children and a fence and a dog.
Right.
And we don't see these other possibilities of what family units are. And so there's this really sort of insidious
projection of the present onto the past without any proof that that's how it was. It's just, we just assume it.
Yeah.
This is Chelsea. I like to refer to it as common sense. I know other people have, there's this, you know, just set of commonsensical notions because they're so like ingrained as being, well, like that's just how the world works. A really good book that's just come out, came out last year, I believe, is Pamela Geller's The Bioarchaeology of Sociosexual Lives.
Yeah.
And she specifically, queers these kind of common sense notions about sex, gender, and sexuality, but specifically from a bioarchaeological perspective. And it just made me think of that with Megan talking about these, you know, representations of hominids.
Well, these sort of quote unquote common sense
projections into the past that we do are very white, Western middle class. You know, if you look at other family groups and other cultures around the world, this sort of nuclear
family is not a given. Even in the United States, we see different family structures in you know, different ethnic groups and different you know, socioeconomic classes. So it's a very
heteronormative, white, middle class
idea
projection that we're making, and that's a problem because that's not telling us anything about these past people. That's just
reifying, you know, this white middle class reality. Yeah. And that's a real problem.
That is a serious problem.
Yeah, apparently just recently, I don't know this for 100%, but from some news sources I was reading, I guess they've found some more footprints at Laetoli. And so more than just the two that have been kind of part of that popular narrative of, you know, human bipedalism tracking through the volcanic ash.
Yeah.
But apparently, at least some of the cursory things, I can't speak for the actual, you know, scholars who are looking at this, but some of the cursory interpretations are, since one of the footprints is very large and then the other, I think four maybe, are small. Some of the cursory things I'm seeing within the popular media is that, oh, clearly this is a male with his four wives.
Oh my God.
You know, maybe that's true, but why is that the first place we go?
Yeah.
And what is this concept of wife?
Exactly.
Let alone anything else, right? You know, that, you know, whether,
I don't know if they used wife, but mates, you know, what have you, but you know, who's to say they're not brothers and sisters, siblings, cousins, a pack of people fleeing from a volcano? Who knows?
Right. And that goes totally back to your point of just like, where's the proof? You know, like, right. Marriage is as much an economic transaction as a social one. And so, you know, to look at footprints in volcanic ash and say, okay, there was definitely like a socioeconomic bond here. I'm sorry. We don't have that. Nah.
Yeah. And when you put it, when you like break it down like that, it sounds ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're assuming a family structure based out of a set of footprints, if nothing else.
Yeah, that's absurd.
And that's a lot to assume. And in that assumption, not only is there a family structure, but possible social,
as well as sexual and gender.
Yeah.
You know, all in one fell swoop based on the size of a set of footprints.
And never mind that, you know, cultures, including our own, have more than one gender.
No, really? Sorry. You can take that out.
But I mean, people don't think about it, but even in our own Western culture, we actually have three genders. We have men, women, and children.
So, you know, even, you know, without getting into sort of the queer gender as a spectrum, ideas, which are, you know,
totally true. We even from our quote unquote binary perspective, we already recognize three genders.
Yeah. And that goes a long way into acknowledging the sex, gender, sexuality nexus that is such a complicated thing. And like you had said, it's a spectrum across, it's a culturally constructed spectrum, and every culture constructs it in different ways and also has, you know, material expressions of that in different ways. And so that's, you know, one of those things that's, I think it's a fascinating problem to look at in archaeology.
Right. And to, you know, and if we want to complicate it more, which I know frustrates the heck out of some archaeologists, and rightly so, is, you know, if we're going to look at identities, we have to be constantly paying attention to, you know, what are the other things, you know, because when we talk about gender, sex, and sexuality, we have to talk about race, we have to talk about ethnicity, and we have to talk about class, because those categories are not perfect, neat, little interchangeable packages. They're, you know, sometimes fluid, they're sometimes structural, they're sometimes both, you know, and people deal with them differently at different points of their lives and different points of society and culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I like to say, intersectionality, it's a thing.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, deal with it.
Yeah, and it's tough. I mean, it's hard when it you is. Have to, it's really easy to say, well, I'm going to look, you know, it's if I just assume that it's a male or female, or male and female, and these are male things, and these are female things, right? And these are class things, and these are, you know, religious things,
Those neat boxes are really easy to write reports around.
But when you start looking at how intertwined those are and how you really can't pull them apart, if you pull them apart too far, you end up with nothing. It's, you know, those reports get more complicated.
And they're harder to write because you can't say, well, here's how we talk about class, 1, 2, 3, you know. It's like, well, here's how we talk about class in the context of race, and it just becomes much more nuanced, which is good.
Yes.
But it is challenging to do. I think that's one of the huge challenges of intersectionality in archaeology is how do you do it? I mean, the theory sounds great, right? The theory makes sense, and it's like, well, yes, of course
all these things are intertwined. But to actually take a data set, right, take your research from a site and do that kind of intersectional interpretation is really...
And not even just interpretation, but how do you plan your research questions and your excavation strategies around an intersectional model, it's hard. And I think that's one of the big challenges in archaeology moving forward.
I completely agree. And I was on the CRM archaeology podcast earlier, and we were talking about a totally separate perspective of it, but we were talking about the limitations of the National Register criteria for making a site eligible for consideration to listing and then preservation and all that. And I think intersectionality is one of those things that is a challenge that is overlooked, I think, by the structure of those kinds of laws. And so when you've got even the criteria for selecting a site as eligible for preservation and study and funding and whatnot, you've got these kind of structures in place where you're saying, okay, it has to be an important event in history. Okay, well, then that means it has to have been written down in history. And who wrote history? Well, that was, it tended to be wealthy white guys. And then important individuals, like if it's an artifact or site related to the work or life of an important individual. So then again, the question comes back around to, all right, well, who would that have been in history? Who got written about in history? Right. Once again, we return to that. And so intersectionality, but then you come back around to criterion D, which is, it has research value. And so I think that's the catch-all that saves a lot of archaeology, and prehistoric sites fall into that. But then also it could let us work with LGBTQ sites. And I think we're going to take a quick commercial break, but when we come back, I think that would be a great time for us to talk about, Megan, your work with the NPS initiative on LGBTQ sure. heritage.
Absolutely, yeah.
Telling a different story to the traditional lines of archaeology, the Anarchaeologist podcast seeks the stories and ideas that are often overlooked or not considered real archaeology. Video games, anarchism, and archaeology in the middle of hostile areas. Host Tristan doesn't search under the rocks, he destroys them. Available on iTunes every fortnight.
Okay, and we're back. And before the commercial break, we were talking about intersectionality and studying sites. And Megan Springate works on the LGBTQ Heritage Initiative with the National Park Service. So could you tell us a little bit about that, Megan?
Sure. From 2014 through end of September of 2016, I was
the prime consultant for the National Park Service LGBTQ Heritage Initiative. And those initiatives are coming out of the National Register and National Historic Landmarks programs, which are Park Service programs.
And they've recognized that there are groups that are underrepresented on the National Register and in the National Historic Landmarks programs. So there are four initiatives underway right now or very recently completed.
One is the LGBTQ, one is Latino, one is Asian American Pacific Islander, and the Women's History Initiative are all sort of recognizing that.
Exactly what you were saying, that these register issues and National Historic Landmark issues are so many of the properties are about rich white guys. Right.
And so how do we working to tell all American stories by increasing representation of these other groups. And so when I started
in 2014 to do the initiative, there were only five LGBTQ places on the National Register and as National Historic Landmarks.
And when the theme study was released this past October, after I started working for the Park Service, there were 10, including Stonewall National Monument, right? So it got a bump up from National Historic Landmark
to monument status. So even just doing having the initiative and working on the theme study encouraged people to start already listing and increasing the representation in those two programs.
The theme study provides a context, an LGBTQ context in American history, and it is designed to help people investigate their
queer history in their communities, and also to be able to place their local history into just this broader context. And then by doing that, be able to say, oh, this place is an important place.
These places are important places. These are significant places. And let's look at, what can we do with significant places? Well, we can nominate them to the National Register, right? So it provides the sort of
basis for communities to work with their queer history, and by engaging with queer history, sort of these significant properties that will meet the requirements
of the Register or the Landmarks programs will sort of pop up to the top. So it's huge. We initially started with this idea of doing a chronological theme study,
pre-Stonewall, Stonewall to HIV, HIV to activism.
Wow.
And when we had a scholars panel of 20 some odd scholars from across the country, and that chronological idea
died almost immediately, because that's a very white, male, middle-class, urban history.
Mm, yeah.
And so we sort of switched it to work thematically, and
really purposefully took an intersectional approach to the theme study, and it means the thing is over 1,200 pages.
It's wow. Huge. I've it's seen huge. A copy of it. You could brain somebody with it.
Yeah, you could.
And it's available for free online on the Park Service website.
Oh, nice! I'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah,
please do, because I mean, as somebody, I had nothing to do with the theme study, but as somebody who has read many parts of it, Megan did a wonderful job, not only in organizing the authors, but also in her own work. She has two really wonderful chapters on archaeological context,
uh-huh.
which I think a lot of your listeners would like, as well as things that are overviews, such as intersectionality, mm-hmm. that people may find very interesting. It really is a wonderful and solidly ethical document that I think is going to change how people think about the National Register in history, I hope.
Yeah,
that's awesome. And I can't wait to share that widely on social media too. I'm curious, and I think a lot of my listeners would be curious too, how do you detect archaeologically, how do you detect LGBTQ heritage, and how are you identifying certain sites as significant to LGBTQ heritage?
So one of the challenges is
that there has not been a lot of work in the United States looking at LGBTQ archaeological sites. And I think part of that is
that people have not wanted to engage in it, particularly in cultural resource management. Let's face it, it's the CRM folks that get their hands on most of the sites. It doesn't end up in reports because they feel that it's a
challenge, right?
Yeah.
So people are not even engaging in the question. But also, I think the question of
how does a straight site look materially different than a queer site?
Right.
It's a question, but to me, it's not a particularly interesting question.
Well, it's not the best question necessarily to ask.
Yeah. So.
Nice.
What I did with the archaeological context was, instead of saying, here are what queer sites look like, I looked at, here are the questions that we can address if we know that we're digging on
an LGBTQ or queer, two-spirit, whatever kind of a site. right? Queer in you know, just, you know, letting me push that back through time, even though this idea of
being a homosexual is just since the 20th century. But so there are things that we can study that are larger questions in archaeology. So we can look at gender, right? Gender is not just
male and female. If you look at even in among women and among lesbians, there's a whole bunch of different ways of being lesbian, and you can consider those all different types of
gender expressions, right? So the lipstick lesbian, butch lesbian, soft butch, stone, you know, all these different ways of being, and all these different ways of being gay men is very or bisexual is
tied into how that sort of gender and social role is expressed. And so, you know, we can think about gender more broadly by looking at these different sort of ways of that queer people
express themselves. Or we can look at what is the difference between, or what is, how does somebody live in the closet in their public life and be gay, lesbian, or bisexual,
or transgender in their private life.
Yeah.
And folks who are working in African American archaeology are already doing work on this sort of double consciousness idea of the sort of personal versus public lives. And so
people are doing this work already. So those are the kinds of larger questions that we can get at by looking at LGBTQ sites that I think are much more interesting personally, but are also more
compelling to the field.
Absolutely. And I think it develops a much richer narrative of the past too, which makes me wonder, do you ever run into issues of, I guess, like outing someone from the past? Would their surviving family or descendants be concerned with that?
So we've been careful in the theme study to not label somebody with a label that they did not or could not
or would not have taken themselves.
Okay.
Which sounds, you know, easy when you're looking back into the 18th century when the term, you know, lesbian or being a homosexual was not a thing, right? It was homosexuality
was something you did. It wasn't something that you were.
Right.
But even more recently, Sally Ride, who was the first woman in American woman in space.
Yeah.
Did not know that she was in a, publicly did not know that she was
in a relationship. We did not know she was in a relationship with a woman for like the last 20 years until her obituary came out. And she never took the identity of lesbian or bisexual on for herself. And so to call her that,
to call her bisexual, she had been married to a man, or to call her a lesbian, I think is a form of violence, right? So
yeah.
Instead of labeling people, we talk about their behavior. So
we talk about her being in a relationship with her long-term partner of 20 some odd years, who was a woman. We talk about people in the past who had relationships with both men and women. And I know it's a difficult
concept. I think there's people who argue for and against that, particularly you look back in time and you assume people were straight and nobody has any problems with that. And so why can't we just, you know, call people queer, call people gay, call people lesbian,
regardless of what they would have done. But I chose to take the sort of more conservative kind of approach in the theme study. And there's definitely examples where people have,
you know, burned their papers and, or their families have burned their papers to protect what they perceive to be something to be ashamed of.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that kind of putting labels on someone is a form of violence. I think that's an important point that a lot of anthropologists and archaeologists need to keep in mind.
Yeah. Well, and it's true, and it extends out, you know, not just, you know, beyond gender and sexuality. Obviously, I mean, we have a long history of how we use names to name indigenous peoples, you know, or race or class in the ways in which we approach kind of the categorization of things and objects and in culture groups that we have studied and turned into these kind of objectified ideas. And those have all been types of violence.
Absolutely. And there's so many parts of the world that are still dealing with hangovers of colonialism because of
including
labeling.
Our own.
Yeah.
Our own, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I think that that raises some other parallels to the creation of identity. So, Chelsea, could you tell us some about your work on identity formation?
Sure. One of the things I've I've spent a long time thinking about has been the categories that we don't talk a lot about and the way in which people do and don't have power and how that's formed, because those things are tied directly into how
society labels somebody and often how a person labels themselves. So for the ancient Maya in particular, I've spent a lot of time considering commoners, lower status peoples, and thinking about how there was more to them than just their class persona. You know, there was gender, sexuality, probably other types of status that we don't quite even understand completely, probably ethnicity, various and sundry things, religious affiliations, kinship. All of these different kinds of things play a role.
And so what queer theory has done is just to kind of let me think more expansively about what we assume about lower status peoples, to really interrogate those assumptions about how society works. Because the assumption, especially for a prehistoric society always in terms of class, is that lower status peoples have little to no power in society, that they have little to no ability to construct, to affect, to really do anything on a major governmental or political policy level. And part of that is because we see them as being outside of things like writing systems and, public rituals. But the very nature of kind of queering and reconsidering something forces us to think a little bit differently about that. What is the exact nature of power, and how do people even unintentionally kind of contribute to the daily changing of how, political systems work? I forget who the author is, but he's a scholar of Middle Eastern studies, and I'm completely blanking on his name currently. But he wrote a book, and he was talking about the politics of every day and the ways in which people can force the government to do things, not through rebellion, which is often where we go for prehistoric societies, but just through the actions that kind of accrue and accumulate over time. For example, people, who don't have power will start stealing power from the state grid. And after so many people do it, sometimes it's collective, but a lot of times it's just gradual groups of people doing this action that finally kind of impacts the state, and the state has to respond. And so right now I'm thinking about the ways in which these intersectional identities force people to think differently about the world, interact with it differently, and then what does it say about power in societies like the ancient Maya?
That's really fascinating. And I think that it has a lot of, you had mentioned this at the beginning of this podcast. I think it's incredibly relevant to current settings on how, identity and various aspects of people's individual lives can collectively impact the state and change state decisions, once it does impact the state. And I think that those are principles that we're going to be seeing a lot more as we see changes in centralized authority, changes in, state encroachment into individual lives, and then vice versa, individual lives and encroachment into, state authority.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
you know, I feel like as archaeologists, we travel this interesting path, and we've mentioned it earlier. I think Megan might have said it, you know, that on the one hand, you don't just want to apply categories from the present, you know, into the past, because that's problematic. But at the same time, that's also our perspective, right? That's how we view the world. So we're all applying some set of categories to the past, because that's the lenses through which we view the world and the words and systems we understand. So to queer something is to, you know, basically constantly question yourself and ask yourself, you know, is this applicable? Are there alternative models or ideas to these? And that's partly what I'm trying to do, is just to think along the lines that, you know, others have about, you know, how is, you know, how are people powerful in different ways? In what ways do we see that represented today? Because I think it's important, if we're, you know, historic archaeologists are, I think, a lot better at telling stories that catch people's attention today, and connecting it. And it may be the shorter distance, mm-hmm. In time. But I think prehistorians can do the same. I think prehistorians, by thinking about, well, what were dimensions of class or gender, sexuality, and like amongst the ancient Maya or Mesoamerican societies? How do these identities, and how we as archaeologists, you know, kind of create them? How do they affect the way we talk about the same things today? You know?
And I think queering stuff is not necessarily about having the answer.
That's true.
But about
asking the questions, excuse me. And, you know, and being able to, and being okay not having the answers, and sort of rolling around the possibilities between the questions and the data, and to say, look, I mean, these could be a number of things, and here are the different kinds of things that happen if I look at these data in a different way, and being okay with like somebody who is genderqueer, being okay with not having, you know, an answer, you know, being okay with being somewhere in that spectrum of not one thing and not another.
Yeah. Well, do you all have anything else that you'd like to add to the podcast? Because I think we're at a good point to start wrapping up the show. But if you have anything else that you feel like you'd like to cover, I'm absolutely happy to cover that.
I just want to give a plug for the Queer Archaeology Interest Group at the Society for American Archaeology.
That's going to be this spring in Vancouver, right?
Correct.
Nice. And I'll be sure to add that to the show links. And also, I had just thought of, and this is how I got in contact with Chelsea in the first place, was I sent a message to the LGBTQ archaeologist Facebook group, and Chelsea responded to that for me. And so if you're interested in that, check that out. There's a lot of great links and posts that come out of that, you know, keep us thinking about queer perspectives in archaeology. And
the one thing I want to say about QUAG real quick is that it is not just for queer people. We would like allies, anybody interested in topics of gender, sex, and sexuality. Even those who are interested in being allies and helping to protect and mentor your LGBTQ colleagues and students. Everyone's welcome.
And I think it's important for folks to know that, because I know being
lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender can be particularly isolating depending on where you're coming from. And just, like, you're not alone in this field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're definitely not alone in this field.
No, and please link the SAA archaeological record that Megan brought up, because I think that gives a lot of particularly younger queer students a place to think and a place to look at.
Yeah, definitely. That was a great issue of the Archaeological Record too. And it had, I remember specifically a piece by Jim Amers, who mm-hmm. I've worked with in Belize before, that was also really good. And so I have one last question, I guess, to close out this episode. You had brought up allies being an important part. What do you see the role of allies being in queer archaeology? Like, for anybody who's not familiar, like, you know, what do allies need to do to help build a more inclusive archaeology and make kind of safe spaces and protective spaces for, you know, queer members of the archaeological community?
I think is to have their backs and, you know,
even model that doing queer archaeological research is okay. You know, you don't have to be queer to do queer archaeology. And, I think a lot of people don't do it because they're
afraid that it's not, quote, legitimate, right? So
yeah.
If we have allies who are in positions of power, your boss, you know, professors who talk about it, who
do research, who ask the research questions, who publish, you know, that makes it okay. Doing the theme study with the National Park Service when I was contracting with them,
you know, made it okay to write these nominations, and nominations have come from queer people and allies. So I think it's letting people have their own voice.
Yeah.
But also letting them know that it's safe to do that.
Nice.
And part of the way you do that as an ally, is to also listen,
yeah,
and educate yourself. And you know, and be okay with the fact that, you know, you may get called out on something, you know, like, because again, a lot of our, you know, preconceived notions and prejudices are, you know, they're ingrained in us. We don't realize them until somebody tells us otherwise. So I think you have to listen and be willing to be open and be willing to look inward to yourself. And that's how you be a good ally.
Yeah. And I think that the willingness to learn and the willingness to face challenges and be corrected and change perspectives is a valuable skill as a whole, as an archaeologist, to carry mm-hmm. on to other aspects of it.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much for joining the show, Megan and Chelsea. And like I said, check out the notes on archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/go-dig-a-hole. We'll have a ton of links for everything we talked about here, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of Go Dig a Hole. As always, you can contact me by email at christopher@godigahole.com or on the Facebook page, Twitter, Instagram, or Snapchat. We've got all the social media bases covered, all at Go Dig a Hole. Don't forget to check out the blog at godigahole.com for long-form companion posts to most of the episodes. Special thanks to Louisville post-punk band Invaders for letting me use their song Dig a Hole for the show's bumper music. Check them out on Bandcamp and download their album by the same name, Dig a Hole. This show was produced and edited by me, your host, Christopher Sims. You can check out the show notes from this and all the other great podcasts on the Archaeology Podcast Network on archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Until next time, go dig a hole.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.